Part 2. Talisman. 1680. 1. Summertime in Massachusetts was sticky with heat and plagued by thunderstorms, and August was the worst of it. Even a weather witch could do little here when faced with the oddities of nature. Occasionally, hailstones as big as a man's hand would fall with a noisy splatter, pelting against roofs and cobbled walkways. The streets ran with waste, and temperatures rose until people were unable to sleep at night. Overheated men roamed the city, courting trouble. Proper women slept without a stitch of clothing and dreamed of lakes and streams, often waking with their hair wringing wet and pools of water mysteriously appearing on the wooden floor beneath their beds. Yet despite the troubles the season brought, every soul in the colony agreed that summer was far too short. No one wished for a New England winter. Winter was severe in every acre of this region, bleak and much more fierce than winters in England, so cold that harbors froze solid. There were those who believed this new country was too frigid for Englishmen, many of whom perished in blizzards freezing in their own beds. The native people vowed that every 10 years there was no winter, but that the years in between made up for that blessed time. It was a land of extremes, and there seemed to be more of everything here, both disaster and promise. And mothers whispered that was the cause that there were so many twins in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, for all here was doubled, even human life. The land itself was huge, endless, some people vowed, with uncharted territories of wilderness, said to be overrun by beasts and natives that the settlers had betrayed and now feared. Essex County itself was large, with many towns and villages. Until Maria could discover where John Hathorne was, she would remain in Boston, boarding near School Street, where the first public school, Boston Latin, had opened in 1635. As always, she kept the window open for Caden, so that he might come and go as he pleased. He continued to bring gifts for Maria from every neighborhood in Boston. Bullets, fish hooks, a blue pearl, scallop shells, colored glass, a key that seemed to fit any door. The crow perched in the rafters of her room, but at night he seemed to know that she was lonely, for he slept beside her, making a nest in the blanket, lulling her to sleep with a clacking sound. Several of Caden's feathers had turned white by this time, and Maria worried over him, although crows could easily live to be 20, and in rare cases such creatures had been known to survive for 30 or more years. "Do not leave me," she whispered to the crow, the same word Samuel Dias had so often said in his sleep. Not that she would think of that, or of him, or consider what he had meant to her. There was a tea house in her lodgings, and in exchange for room and board, Maria was employed as a cook. She knew the basics of Hannah's simple cookery, and she quickly learned the American specialties favored by their customers. Odd as these dishes were to her palate, she soon grew accustomed to the strange food she ladled out each evening. Cod and mashed potatoes, baked beans that had been soaked in cold water overnight, and were then cooked for hours with salt pork, stewed pumpkins, yellow and green native squashes, pot pies of every sort, boiled clams, cherry and plum puddings, as well as a dish known as Indian pudding, a great favorite of Faith's, for it was a heavenly mixture of scalded milk, Indian meal, molasses, cinnamon, and ginger. Maria had learned to tell the difference in the fish she used. Cod was good for boiling and had white stripes, and haddock was best for frying and had black stripes. On Tuesdays, she baked Shrewsbury cakes, buttery and flavored with rosewater. On Saturdays, there was bird's nest pudding, made of cored apples and egg custard. Best of all were Sundays, when she fixed apple fritters, battered apples fried and coated with sugar and cider, or on special occasions, an apple pie, Faith's favorite. For those who had a taste for tart desserts, there were slices of cranberry spice pie flavored with nutmeg and cinnamon, or hard gingerbread, which kept well for weeks. Courage tea was always called for, especially when a woman had a difficult decision before her, or when the right words could not be found, although they needed to be said. Every morning, Maria made her daughter a breakfast of gruel, oats settled in cold water, boiled with raisins, sugar, and a pinch of salt and nutmeg. Faith was an early walker, and by the summer's end, she often toddled about from table to table with her favorite poppet in hand. Maria laughed to think that her doll had been sewn by a sailor who had fought battles at sea and thought nothing of engaging in bloodshed. She was reminded of Samuel's charm and his open smile and his reckless brand of self-confidence that had made her laugh out loud, for in his opinion, there was nothing he could not do. She looked at the poppet and thought perhaps this was true. Sailors had endless time at sea, hours in which they took up what were ordinarily considered the female arts. They fashioned extraordinary boxes decorated with shells, knit scarves, learned to sew. Maria recalled the times she had slept beside Samuel when he was burning with fever, and closer to death than she'd let on. She still missed their intimacy. All that talk, all those stories, were like a river she had dived into. She told herself it was only natural to think of him, for they had held each other and had once or twice done more. But perhaps her thoughts were drawn to him because she had saved him, and her connection to him was not unlike someone who had rescued a dog from an icy pond or a bird from a tangle of thickets, nothing more. Faith often called out for the sailor, puzzled by the fact that he was no longer in their lives. Maria would then shake her head. "He's out at sea," she'd tell the baby. When the child would not stop calling Go-Go, Maria brought her to the wharf. She gestured to the harbor and the waves beyond. "That's where he is," she told her daughter. "He's gone." Secrets were hard to keep, even in Boston, and word of Maria's talents soon spread through the city, with each client telling the next her address. These referrals were knots in a rope, buds on a tree, birds that sang to summon others who might need a tonic or a cure. Soon a line of women waited at the back door after dark, their shawls drawn over their heads, for no one wished to be recognized if a neighbor happened to pass by. Some called Maria Owens a healer. Others said she was a witch. Those who feared magic came for her help anyway, regardless of what their fathers or husbands might say, had they known their daughters and wives had come to a woman who was an expert in the nameless art. The ill, the old, the lovesick, the brokenhearted, the abandoned, the hopeful, the cursed, the fevered, the fallen, all arrived after dark, when the streets were empty and the harbor quiet and rats ruled the city. As always, most came for love. Maria wasn't surprised, for this had been true in Devotion Field, and Hannah had always said love sickness afflicted most of those who came to her door. In many cases, a simple cure would do. The most reliable love potions were the ones Maria had learned watching from a corner as Hannah worked her magic. A woman could plant an onion and keep it on her windowsill. She could write her own name and her intended's on a white candle and burn it without ever extinguishing the flame. She could braid a strand of her own hair with her beloved's and keep it under her pillow. When the 8 lesser charms had been tried and had met with failure, Maria turned to the 9th, which did no harm and could not force love, but instead gently invited it to walk through the door. Love Potion Number 9. 9 ounces red wine, 9 basil leaves, 9 rose petals, 9 cloves, 9 apple seeds, 9 anise seeds, 9 drops of vinegar. Combine all ingredients on the 9th hour of the 9th day of the month. The effect is strongest when performed on the 9th month of the year. Stir 9 times. Let the one who drinks this wine grant me true love divine. The 10th love potion, the one Rebecca had cast upon Lachland, was written down in Maria's grimoire, but she had made an oath never to use it, not for any woman who came calling, no matter how desperate, and certainly never for herself. It was a spell written in blood, able to turn a person inside out with raw emotion, and it could not be reversed without grave consequences. The 10th was a dangerous spell, as much of ancient magic was. It called on elemental powers that could turn one's beloved's heart to stone if the slightest error was made in its creation, and the ingredients could cause complete havoc if not used correctly. Hannah had done her best to correct these effects for Maria's mother, but in the end, she had merely reversed it. The opposite of love was hate, and Thomas Lachlan had that emotion in his heart when he burned down the cottage. The 10th was said to be unbreakable, and nothing in this world should be so, for all that is, and ever will be, must change. The winter of 1680 in Boston was one that consisted of hard work and days that grew dark at 4 in the afternoon. The temperatures were so cold that bread rattled on the plate, and people wore every item of clothing they owned at the same time, one layer over the other. It was a bad time to search Essex County for John, and Maria decided to stay at the boarding house until the weather turned. During her time of employment, she and the proprietor, Mrs. Henry, had grown quite close. Both were women on their own in the world, after all, and both were willing to open the door to anyone in need. Maria's talents were evident, and the line outside their door grew to be surprisingly long. There were those who must set 2 eggs, never to be eaten, beneath their beds to clean a tainted atmosphere, and those who were to use black mustard seed to repel nightmares, those who were told to use vinegar for husbands who could not perform in bed, and were told to feed their men chestnuts and oysters to inflame desire, those who asked for "Be true to me" tea for straying husbands. Still others came for a remedy of garlic, salt, and rosemary, the most ancient spell to cast away evil. Many wanted Maria's teas, concocted late at night by lantern light. Fever tea was composed of bayberry, ginger, cinnamon, thyme, and marjoram. Frustration tea was made of chamomile, hyssop, raspberry leaf, and rosemary. Courage tea was the great favorite, Hannah's old recipe, and pots of it were served day after day. When Mrs. Henry looked at Maria, she saw a healer, not a witch, and she would always be grateful for the Lily of the Valley tea Maria had used to stop the older woman's heart from fluttering one night when she fell faint. Mrs. Henry swore she would surely be in her grave if not for that curative. She opened her heart to Maria and her charming little girl, and was happy to share her own cures. Boston remedies: honey and milk for worms, salt and molasses for cuts, huckleberries boiled for stomach aches, balm of Gilead buds boiled into a paste for wounds, dark blue violets as a tincture for mouth sores, chickweed prevents toothaches, table salt and vinegar fermented for colic, castor oil, milk, and sugar for a children's tonic. Maria had confided that she was in search of a man, like so many women who had been forsaken by husbands and fathers who had come to the New World, promising to send for them, then disappearing into cities or the wilderness. This came as no surprise to Mrs. Henry. Women in search of men were nothing new in Boston. There were signs tacked to lampposts and on market stalls with descriptions of lost husbands, which sometimes included the image of a face, drawn to the best of the bereaved's abilities. Maria could often see where the missing were when she set out a pan of water for scrying, and she gave out the addresses of lost men, many of whom didn't wish to be found. She warned her clients that sometimes it was best to let the lost remain so, for they might not be pleased once their loved ones were located. Try as she might, Maria could not see John, not in the water and not in the black mirror, which she kept carefully stored in a piece of blue flannel so that it would not break. Hannah had told her that when a person looked in the mirror, she would see what she must, not what she wished to see. John was never there. She could only see him in her daughter's features. The high cheekbones, the lanky arms and legs, the particular way she laughed with her head thrown back, exactly as her father had when he stepped into the turquoise water and found the world to be a miracle. It was Mrs. Henry who directed Maria to Salem. By then, it was early spring, and Faith had passed her first birthday. The ice was melting in the streets, and as always at this time of year, the harbor was filled with ships. A customer returning from London mentioned he was on his way home to Essex County. "How many people can there be in one county?" Mrs. Henry said to Maria. "Perhaps he'll know your man." Maria brought the gentleman a bowl of her apple pandowdy, apples baked in a crust, a delicious end to his dinner, and when he thanked her, she asked if perhaps he might have heard of a man named John Hathorne. Indeed, there was a well-known magistrate in Salem by that name, a man of wealth. "It's a strict village with Puritans setting down their rules, not just for themselves, but for everyone." Maria had no fear of rules, and she thanked the customer for his help. "Now I'll lose my cook," Mrs. Henry said sorrowfully, when she saw the expression on Maria's face, for one didn't need the ability to see into the future to comprehend what would happen next. That night, Maria had difficulty sleeping. When at last she fell asleep, she dreamed of a ship at sea. In her dream, she held her grimoire in her hands, open to a page on which a map had been spun out of stars. It was a map she couldn't read, and she was as lost and alone as she had been in the field of snow when Caden found her and sat on the rim of her basket, refusing to leave her. And then she was no longer alone. Hannah sat across from her in her dream, as real as she'd been on the last day they had spent together. Their boat drifted in a vast and endless sea. But there was great comfort in being in Hannah's presence, even in a dream. Fate is what you make of it. You can make the best of it, or you can let it make the best of you. The fish swimming beneath their boat were huge, dark shadows, but Maria paid them no mind. Stars fell from the sky. Clouds appeared, gray and swollen, promising storms. The world was cold, but there was a flame burning inside her. Hannah leaned forward to whisper, "Life is not what you think it is. Remember that. Remember me." When Maria woke, she had already decided she must leave for Essex County without delay. Her future was waiting for her, and it would be best for her to discover what was in store. She had most likely stayed too long in Boston. She wondered why she had been unable to find John Hathorne on her own, for she had sighted countless lost men for so many women. There was a problem that thwarted her. That much was evident. She set to work baking a love cake, using the recipe Hannah had taught her. It was a skillet cake, made over the fire, and as it baked, it turned from white to red. She set it out to cool, but an hour later returned to find that the cake had been devoured by ants. It was a dark sign, but one she ignored as she threw away what was left of the cake. Believe what the world shows you and make no excuses. See what is right before you. Instead, Maria told herself that it was impossible to control all living things and all occurrences. Not even magic could do that. There was farmland ringing Salem, with fields of grass and black-eyed Susans, and farther in the distance, a deep forest of ancient woodland. Spring was madness in New England, all the world come to life at once. Pine, oak, chestnut, plum tree, elm, walnut, ash, witch hazel, and wild cherry all grew here. There were mallows and white hellebore in great profusion in the marshes, used as a curative for wounds and aches, and clusters of loosestrife with vivid purple flowers. In the shadows, there was nightshade, black henbane, wormwood, and bloodwort. The North River flowed inland, and there were marshes and tide pools dotting the land. Salem itself was bustling, and was always so, no matter the hour. This seafaring community had been settled in 1626 at the site of a native village and was the second oldest settlement in Massachusetts, named after the Hebrew word for peace, shalom. It was here the first Puritan church had been built by those who'd fled England in search of freedom. But once the refugees arrived in a land they claimed as their own, they became as intolerant as their persecutors had been. They insisted upon purity that did not deviate from their beliefs, ensuring that all would live within the scriptures as they saw them, rejecting the ways of sin practiced in England. The soul was said to be divided into two halves, the immortal half, which was male, and the mortal half, which was female, set in place by Eve's original sin. It was women who were more likely to carry sin, to keep it in their hearts, to veer from the path of the righteous. The settlers believed with utter certainty that the world to come was predestined. Some were condemned to hell in an unbroken fate that could not be altered, while others would receive God's grace no matter what their earthly deeds might be. The only mercy that could be shown was divine. It was not for men to forgive. They were merely to enforce the rules of God and make certain they were obeyed. Deviation from the rules meant severe punishment. Lashings, whippings, the stocks, prison, being sent into the wilderness. Women in Essex County were not allowed to wear fine clothes, for such attire might awaken the evil impulses of both demons and men. Female members of the community were expected to dress plainly, in austere gray dresses of a color known as liver. Brown and indigo were sometimes used, for the dye was cheap, but only the wealthy wore black, for it was an expensive color to produce. Vanity was not allowed, and silk and lace were considered sinful. There were to be no scarves and no embroidered needlework. There had recently been cases in the nearby town of Newbury of women who had been arrested for wearing silk hoods. Long hair was outlawed, for it called up unwanted desire. There were to be no kid gloves or silk-laced shoes, no gold or silver jewelry. Puritans placed meaning in the color of clothes. Black symbolized humility. Russet and brown, made from madder root dye, was the color of poverty. Gray meant repentance. And white, the color of caps and cuffs and collars, was purity and virtue. Wickedness could easily be found in this part of the world. Hands must be kept busy to prevent evil deeds and to keep God's favor, which many thought had been lost when there were several years of failed crops and famine. It was in God's name that the Puritans made their attack against the native people and the French, a vicious endeavor called King Philip's War, named after the Wampanoag chief who had taken the name Philip and led a bloody uprising that had lasted 14 months. The English took what they wanted and felt was divinely given to them, land they claimed for God, but kept for their own use. One must be careful to keep oneself in God's light and not in the devil's darkness. Women must keep their eyes lowered, their voices soft. They must not ask for what they did not deserve, or think themselves above others, or pursue any vile needs or desires. Mrs. Henry had told Maria to keep her head covered so that her glossy black hair wouldn't be seen. Puritans rejected beauty in a woman, Mrs. Henry warned, just as they feared independence in the sex they deemed responsible for Adam's downfall and the trials of all men who had followed. Maria carried the baby on her hip, and Caden in his case made of reeds. From the start, the crow made it clear that he was unhappy with their destination, clattering nasty clicks as if scolding his mistress. Caden put up such a racket that at last Maria paused on the street to open his cage. He peered at her with his glittering eye, sulking as he had on the day when Rebecca Lachlan had knocked at the door, as annoyed as he'd always been when John Hathorne had come to call in Curacao. "Go on," she urged, when he glared at her with fierce disapproval. Caden would always be her dearest friend, but perhaps he was jealous of John. Certainly he had never taken to him. "You asked to be free. Go have a look at this town." The crow disappeared above the rooftops, a black streak in the sky. If he didn't wish to help her find John, so be it. They'd make amends. They always did. For they had similar temperaments, cool and mistrustful, but ultimately forgiving. She had decided she would no longer have doubts. A black heart could belong to anyone, and she would ignore the image she had seen. This was the day when she was to step into her future. She wore a serge dress, hand-stitched by Mrs. Henry for the occasion, dyed with blue composition, an inexpensive dye made of indigo, and sold as a liquid in small glass bottles, a common enough color in Boston, but one which stood out here in Salem, where the women most often wore gray. She had on her red boots, still as good as new, and in her hair were the blackened silver hair clips that she considered to be good luck, even though a witch makes her own luck, and silver meant less to her than remembrance. Her lovely face shone in the sunlight, perhaps even more than it might have elsewhere, for sunlight was a rare occurrence in this city. Maria had brought along some Johnny cakes for Faith to eat on the journey, and some salt cod for herself, and as they went along the road, she'd picked handfuls of ripe blackberries. Although the baby was hungry, Maria's stomach was a nest of nerves and she couldn't bring herself to eat. Whenever she closed her eyes, she saw herself holding a black heart in her hands. "Turn it over once for love, twice for betrayal, three times for heartbreak." Maria was young, her look striking with her black hair, silver-gray eyes, and slim, reedy body. "Puritans are men," Samuel Diaz had warned her, "no matter how many prayers they say." Instinctively, she searched for a woman's help, which she found when she approached an inn on the wharf. When she mentioned Hathorne to a barmaid there, she was directed to Washington and Court Streets. If Maria was in search of the magistrate, that was where he would be found, at the court or city hall. His house was on Washington Street as well. "But if I were you, I'd avoid that place," the barmaid confided. She was a Dutch Protestant and did her best to live in the Puritans' world. "They've got their rules, and we'd do best to stay far away from them." Maria followed the directions she'd been given. She stood on a corner of the cobbled street and observed a row of elegant houses. Better to find him at home, she decided, as they'd found one another in the blue dining room in Curacao. She would know which house was his when she came upon it. As she closed her eyes, she saw it in her mind's eye. A large house with black shutters that were thrown open on summer mornings before the heat turned brutal. the cloudy windows where he stood to watch snowfall on dark winter days. She felt the tug inside her, and there she was, standing in front of John Hathorne's house, a world away from the country of heat and light where they'd met, where women went barefoot, and men were willing to jump into the sea-green water, and no one who saw such behavior would give it a thought. The bricks in front of the house were patterned in diamond shapes, a formation that is said to bring bad luck. But Maria would not think of luck. Still, the mark on her inner arm had begun to burn, as though it were a star that had fallen from heaven to earth. When a witch's mark burns, she had best be aware of the dangers that surround her, for it is a warning that should never be overlooked. Hannah had taught her not to ignore her intuition, telling her not to look away or think all will be well if she wished it to be. Pay attention. Pay heed. Listen to the voice inside. The two large elm trees in his yard displayed a peculiar black leaf. When the leaves fell in autumn, a black carpet led to the gabled entranceway, but in summer they provided a welcome bower of shade. When Maria approached, the leaves that had only recently unfurled began to fall, as if autumn had come early. She could see nothing through the small casement windows with leaded diamond-shaped panes. To summon John to her, she rubbed her wrists with lavender oil. She had a pocket full of bird bones gathered from the grass of grazing land in Boston, then strung on a bit of rope that she wore around her wrists. They were spells for love and for remembrance. She wore Caden's black feather in a charm at her throat. They waited for nearly 2 hours until Faith grew cranky and hungry. Little Faith was not as patient as Maria had been as a baby. She had a bit of a temper, as red-haired children often do. Maria hushed her, but some things have only a single remedy. Because the baby needed to be fed, and because there was nowhere else to go, Maria made her way up the path to the garden, where she sat in the sunlight, the baby at her breast. Someone had carefully tended the kitchen garden here, planting seedlings of parsley and chervil, summer savory, thyme, sage, and spearmint. The black leaves continued to fall, their shapes forming black hearts in the grass. As he approached the house, John Hathorne spied a crow in the tree. A chill went through him, even though the day was fine, or at least it had been until this very moment. He had a true distaste for such creatures, and had ever since Curacao, when that horrible pet of the Janssen's housemaid spat stones at him. Hathorne was accompanied now by the captain of one of his fleets of ships, scheduled to leave soon for the West Indies. A stone hit him as they spoke of sugar and slaves, grazing his cheek and drawing blood. He gazed upward, and there was the vicious feathered beast. Although few men could tell one crow from another, he swore it was the same foul bird he'd known in the West Indies, who had taken pleasure in tormenting him. It was the glint in the creature's eye that gave him away, the way he held his head proudly, as if he were as good as any man. If it was the bird he knew, it occurred to him that he was being threatened. He quickly made his excuses to the captain. He was so sorry to change their plans, but they would have to speak in the morning. He professed to be ill, and perhaps he was. Certainly he couldn't think straight, and his gut was lurching. Like many in this world, he had two souls residing inside him, the man he wished to be, and the man he actually was. Here in Essex County, he was the man he'd been trained to be, his father's son, a magistrate who did not stray, whose judgments were cast upon others, never upon himself. He saw a woman's figure in his own garden and was completely baffled. It was as if a wolf had come to lie beside the hollyhocks, or a lynx had climbed upon the roof, or worse, a witch had followed him across the seas. It was she. He knew her as he'd known the crow. His deeds had come back to haunt him. He rubbed his eyes, hoping the vision would disappear. But the scene remained the same. A woman wearing red boots, which were outlawed in this town, intent on the child in her arms. He had never imagined her here in this landscape, where the clouds billowed and the sky turned gray late in the day and black leaves fell. They fell now, as if the trees had been shaken and the world had fallen apart, and not even seasons knew their time and place. She was still a beauty, but he was now the other man, the one he'd been born to be, his father's son, and Curaçao was only a dream to him. He considered his own behavior on that island to be a mystery. Men were undone in mysterious ways. They stopped thinking and only felt when they wanted what didn't belong to them, and they often did as they pleased in a strange country where rose-colored birds stood on one long leg in blue-green sea, and the women could bewitch you if you weren't careful, if you didn't keep your head and remember exactly who you were, a man who owned ships and wharfs and warehouses and a house with black shutters, whose father and grandfather had been men of honor, all magistrates, all respected citizens who kept their word and made certain others kept theirs. These were men who would never have leapt into the sea fully clothed, shouting with joy, grinning like a fool, as if a demon had entered to use the darkness inside of them for ungodly purposes. Maria sat beside a bank of tall, snow-white phlox. Nearby in the kitchen garden, fennel and purple cabbage and radishes would soon be grown. There were no lilacs, as there had been in the vision in the black mirror, but surely she could plant them when she was John's wife and this was her house. She would have Persian lilacs in shades of purple and violet and blue, with blooms so sweet women passing by would stop, unable to go any farther, called to the spot as if their names had been spoken aloud. A bee came to examine Faith's hair, red as a flower in the bright sunlight. Maria sent it off with a polite nod. "Be elsewhere," she whispered, and it happily complied. In the tree with black leaves, Caden was clacking and tossing down pebbles. Maria gave him a dark look, but otherwise paid him no mind. She could not let a crow make her decisions. Her fate was her own, and she would certainly make the best of it before it made the best of her. She set her sleeping baby in the grass. To call John to her, she took a laurel leaf from her satchel and held it in the palm of her hand, then set it on fire with a single breath, not minding that she scorched her own skin. The smoke was thin and green, so fragrant it was impossible to ignore. She said his name backwards, chanting beneath her breath. From behind the gate, he felt the thrill of seeing her again. She was like no other woman he had ever seen or known, and when she called to him, he felt his desire in the pit of his stomach. Sins were committed every hour of every day, and it was clear that this woman was unnatural in some way. But who among them had not committed a sin? The eternal torments of original sin had waited for mankind from the moment Adam ate the apple, which was handed to him by Eve, an act that proved to him and his brethren that women were spiritually inferior to men, weak with human frailty, sinful at their core. John entered the garden and closed the open gate behind him. Always bad luck. He was wearing the same black coat he hadn't bothered to take off when he swam alongside the turtle, when he didn't know the difference between a miracle and a monster. It had been laundered with hot water and lye soap, and yet there was still sand in the seams. He looked at Faith, dozing in the afternoon light. She might be anything at all, an angel beside the snowy phlox, a wicked changeling sent in the guise of a red-haired girl. But her features were not unlike his. the same narrow nose and high cheekbones. She was merely his child. He softened then, and perhaps he smiled, for as Maria gazed up to see him, she believed she saw his heart beating beneath his black coat. Maria turned her attention to the bee that now came to sting Faith. The child let out a cry so filled with shock and pain that the sparrows in the garden took flight all at once. For a moment the sky was dark as the leaves from the black elm fell to litter the path, as if they were bats falling from the branches. Maria quickly removed the stinger from her baby's arm, then rubbed some lavender oil on the rising welt. "Hush," she told the child. "All better." She picked up the dying bee and cast it into the bed of phlox. Some creatures do not care how polite a person might be. They will hurt you for no reason, and then all you can do is heal yourself with whatever ingredients are necessary. John's heart was twisted in two between what he wanted and what he must do. He took her hands in his and drew her to her feet. He embraced her then, and so it came as a surprise when he said, "We must leave this place." "What do you mean? I've brought you your daughter." Hathorne gazed at the child's hair. It was a time when many people believed red-haired women to be witches and imagined those with freckles had been marked by the devil, especially if they were left-handed, another evil trait. Redheads were said to be violent in temperament, false in nature, evil in intent. But this darling baby smiled up at Hathorne. "Go," she said in her sweet voice. Maria laughed. The babe thought Samuel Diaz had returned. No, this isn't Goat. He's another man." At the mention of a man, and one with a name that called Satan to mind, Hathorne flared with jealousy. What was his alone, even when he wasn't certain he wanted the prize. "Am I not her father?" Yes, Maria assured him. Diaz was her patient, nothing more. A friend, perhaps, a confidant, the man of 1,000 stories, far away and out of mind. The one she embraced in bed, the one she allowed to kiss her until she was burning, but she always stopped him before she was completely his. There was John to think of, and loyalty, and their daughter. "Of course she's yours." "Then we must go now, for safety's sake." He led her from the yard, the baby still whimpering. When at last they reached the far end of the street, Hathorne drew Maria into a doorway so he might kiss her. Once begun, he could not get enough of her, though she held the baby in her arms. He knew that his desire could be his undoing. He was not young, though he was handsome enough so that women in town failed to lower their eyes when they passed him by, daring to smile and perhaps take his arm so they might make their interest clear. But those were inappropriate flirtations, nothing more. This was an enchantment, and he, who judged others harshly when they came before him in his chambers, did not judge himself for his wrongdoings. A spell was at work, and as he had leapt into the water in Curacao, he embraced her now, but only for a moment, for this was not the time or the place. They went to the edge of town, past the fields and woods so dense it was difficult to navigate through the branches. Though many trees had been cut down, as more and more land was cleared for Indian corn and other crops, the forests were still deep. Salem seemed destined to grow until it met up with the forest and claimed all the land. But for now, it was still a mysterious and dangerous place. There were great gray owls in the trees here. Gnats filled the air and poisonous plants grew nearby. Stalks of horse nettle and chokeberries and toxic wild cherries that contained cyanide. It was dark and damp, and so green the world seemed black. Black hearts grew in the lacy leaves of ferns, and there were mushrooms in the shadows, and black forget-me-nots that were already wilting in the sunlight. As they walked, John explained that his father was a stern, overbearing man, and that here in Salem, the court and the magistrates would consider a child born outside of marriage a crime. He could find himself in jail, for this world was different than Curaçao, with rules that couldn't be broken. Without marriage, a child would always be an outcast. Here, he explained to Maria, people looked for monsters, not for miracles. What is there to do? Maria said, her mood darkening. Perhaps it was the unfamiliar landscape that made it seem as though the man was unfamiliar as well. And yet Maria believed that now that she and Faith had arrived, Hathorne would change back into the man she had known. The man who had fallen in love with her was inside of him. Our child exists, she said. Who could fault us when there wasn't time to marry? Faith's encounter with the bee had exhausted her, and she had fallen asleep on her mother's shoulder, her face hot and streaked with tears. Every now and then Maria patted the baby's back. They might fault us, Hathorne said, but we do not need to fault ourselves. He looked at her the way he had on the island, and Maria was relieved to see the man she had known. She followed John, who was so tall he cast a shadow before him. He had taken her hand, and she could feel his heat. They went on through, past the elms and the wild cherry trees already laden with fruit, with its poison seeds. He knew of an abandoned cabin often occupied by hunters in autumn, but deserted in all other seasons. Maria and the baby would be safe there until he could sort out what to do about his family. They were far enough from town, Hathorne said. Hidden, Maria thought. Not fit for the company of others. When they arrived, Maria peered inside the cabin. Leaves covered the floor, ashes filled the fireplace, and pottery was broken and scattered about. Cutlery left unwashed had been strewn upon a small wooden table. In a corner were straw pallets and several threadbare woolen blankets. Once inside, Maria found a spoon to cast out the door, as her mother had done time and time again to be rid of bad luck. But the spoon was tin, not silver. It didn't turn black in her touch, and rather than being flung into the distance, it landed at her feet, clattering upon her red boots. A dozen crows were in the trees, but Caden was not among them. He was making himself scarce, and in doing so he made his annoyance evident, as it was whenever she was with John. The baby was bundled in her blanket, with Maria's name stitched at one corner and Faith's name stitched below her mother's, with the blue thread Rebecca had given her. Blue for protection and remembrance. Hathorne embraced Maria fiercely. He would have had her right there if she hadn't stopped him. His hands were all over her, so hot they burned her skin. She thought of the laurel leaf aflame in her hand. She'd called him to her, but now she backed away. Do good among them, Hannah always said, but do not expect the same in return. If they have set out rules in this town, let us act by them, Maria said. If marriage was what this world insisted upon, then marriage it would be. Here in these woods, in the second Essex County she had known, Maria thought of Hannah's burning house. Most witches feared water, but Maria feared fire. She thought of the day when Lachlan and his brothers arrived, when the air had filled with the stems and petals from the poison garden. Her eyes had burned for days afterward, perhaps from the billows of smoke, perhaps from the tears she couldn't shed. It was so easy to make a mistake in matters of love. So many women had made their way across Devotion Field, convinced they must make the wrong man their own. Maria had done her best to help those who came to her in Boston, even the ones who knew they should let go of love. Now she asked for marriage, even though she thought of another man. There was a cure for this, she knew. But to set a spell upon herself was dangerous, and she could not stop such thoughts by sheer willpower if she tried. O amour, meant sweetheart, darling, flame, love. That is what Samuel Diaz had called out in his sleep, and it was only now that Maria realized he might have been speaking to her. My pledge remains the same, Hathorn told her. For now he would bring all she might need to stay in the cabin, bedding and pots and pans, baskets of apples and onions, ginger and butter and eggs, odd vegetables Maria had never seen before. He returned the next night and the night after that. They took a late supper together, cooked over a fire. Before she'd left Boston, Mrs. Henry had taught her how to fix Salem pudding, a favored dish made of flour, milk, molasses, and raisins, all boiled for hours, and how to make a quick meal of Johnny cakes, with Indian meal and flour, one egg, a little sugar, and salt and soda. John praised the tea she made and said it gave him the strength and courage to try to set things right. In time, Maria relented, and while Faith slept, she took him to her bed, the straw pallet where hunters camped after the leaves turned, when they came to shoot deer and wild fowl. Spring passed into summer, and some evenings John could not get away. On these nights, there was nothing but darkness and the flicker of the fireflies, creatures unknown in England. They rose amid the trees in globes of pale yellow light, signaling to one another. Is this what love is? Maria might have asked Hannah Owens, who'd been betrayed by a man who claimed she spoke with Satan and had sworn to the judges that beneath her skirts she possessed a tail. Is love not more than this? She might have asked her mother, who pledged her life to a man who charmed her with words that weren't his own. She knew something was wrong, even within her own heart. But then John would return, as though he'd never been gone, full of apologies and promises. It was his family, he explained, and their austere view of the world that was at issue, and the differences between them. Maria had not been raised in any church. She did not live by the tenets of Puritan beliefs. She had a child without the benefit of marriage. She would not be accepted. And yet he returned. He could not stay away, he told her. Was this love? She might have asked herself, if she hadn't feared the answer. On nights that she spent alone in the second Essex County, she couldn't help but wonder if she had been the one who had mistaken a monster for a miracle. She was a world away from Devotion Field, far from everything she had known. She could hear owls and the sound of deer mice and the pine needles. At night, when she was alone in her bed and John had left her, she could hear her own heart beat. She had seen this before, a woman arriving at Hannah's door. Love gone sour. Love gone wrong. Love that wasn't love at all.